Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Like flowers cultivate in cracks in the concrete, culture grows in the spaces between the everyday. It's there in darkened rooms when the stage lights come on. It's in a park full of people belting out the same song. It happens in classrooms having a go, hands on. It's found in small circles exchanging stories. It's under a tent making brand new discoveries. It's in those shared experiences that help build communities. It inspires change, provides opportunities. It brings joy, sparks curiosity. It provokes feelings recognizable to everyone, making our hearts race and giving us goosebumps. It's for those who don't think they can have it. It's for those who know that they need it. It fosters connection and understanding. It is ours for the taking, as well as the sharing. Culture is what makes us human. It makes our world better. Culture is our culture. Let's explore it together.
Thank you very much. Hello, I'd love to see you all. Welcome to this chat with Richard Osman. I'm Richard Herring. Two Richards.
Big no jokes there.
A big one and a little one. we're going to be talking about this fantastic new book, The Bullet That Missed. I should say that the audience here, you can join in on slido.com and ask some questions. and I will select your question if it's good enough and ask it near the end. So if you want, if you've got questions, go to slido.com and you can join in with the fun. Hello, yeah. Richard.
Hello. Essentially, if your question is about Richard Herring, he will definitely read it out. That's my that's my little tip.
If you want to mention my book, Can I Have My Ball Back, then just put that near the start.
It's nice to be here for the first convention of the Anti-Growth Coalition.
There's a lot of us. Most of the Tory party as well are part of it.
I think it's everyone apart from one person at the moment.
Look, this book is my favourite of the three so far. But I thought the other two were rubbish.
Yeah, there you go, yeah.
No, I thought the other two...
That's how I did it. Start badly.
Yeah. Because I think you grow into the character as well, and you as an author have grown into the characters. Do you want to? It's so hard with a book like this that's so full of twists and turns. You don't want to give anyway any spoilers. Do you want to give your synopsis of where we start with this book?
Yeah, I can give a rough one. I know some people will not have read it, and I am signing afterwards in the Waterstones tent. So I'll hopefully see lots of you there. It's this one. Listen, there's more trouble for the Thursday Murder Club. That will not shock you. There's a murder.
What?
Huh? That is, you didn't quite capture the gasp there, did you, on audio? But there was an audible gasp. And essentially, it sort of set. I start by thinking. I just had this thing. You know, and everyone here in Cheltenham will know it. You know, local news.
Yes.
And you know, on the nightly local news, your local newsreaders are the most famous people in a particular area.
Yeah.
Right. And no one from anywhere else has ever heard of them. But in a particular area, they're world famous. And I was thinking that, and when you go around the country and you watch other people's local news, you realise that the format is the same, in that there's a 70-year-old man who's been there for 40 years, and every 5 years they replace the woman who reads the news with him. Anyway, I love those sort of those guys who've read the news forever and ever, and I wanted a character like that. So it's a story about a local news journalist who was murdered, and... Essentially, we get into the story because Joyce, you'll be shocked to learn, fancies the guy who reads the news and thinks if they look into the case that she might get to meet him / marry him. No spoilers, she does not end up marrying him in this book. And then essentially we get into this story, and Mike Waghorn is the name of the news reporter, and Bethany Waits is the woman who's been murdered. And we follow that story to its conclusion.
We certainly do. And I want to say, I think it's an absolutely fantastic title for this book.
The Bullet That Missed.
Yeah, I think it's a very...
Do you know what? This is Richard has only said that because in the acknowledgements, my partner Ingrid is in the front row, came up with the title. And Richard was just talking to her before we came on stage. Because I had a different title, which was The Third Bullet. Which, it made more sense to the plot at the time. I actually had to slightly reverse engineer the plot to make this title work. But I think The Bullet That Missed is a good...
I think it's a very good title. And once you've read the book, it's an even better title. But it's still a good...
That's the idea. I like all the titles to sort of make you sort of ask a question. Like, why was there a murder club on a Thursday? How could a guy die twice? A bullet that missed? That's not interesting. Currently trying to come up with a title for the fourth one. It's really hard to come up with titles.
Well, yeah, as there's a few bits in this book that may have come from your own experience. There's a game show host and a game show involved in it, and there's an author who comes up with quite bad titles for his books.
Yeah, there's like one of Mike Waghorn, the news reporters. I won't give away any spoilers, I absolutely promise you, but one of his previous co-hosts was this woman called Fiona Clements, who's gone on to become a big quiz show host. And essentially I send Joyce and Elizabeth off to watch her recording her daily quiz show at Elstree Studios, which is where we do Pointless. And I say, no spoilers, but they're both carrying a bag, and in Joyce's bag there are fruit pastels, and in Elizabeth's bag there's a gun. Apart from that, there's no spoilers. But that was fun. That was fun to do. So the plot is not based around this daytime quiz show, but writing a scene... You know, somewhere. Essentially, I was writing the place where I work, and thinking how lovely it would be to have Elizabeth and Joyce sort of come to visit.
Yeah.
And little things like the copy editor, who's always, who's the person who says, You say that the 9:35 Polegate to Victoria train has a trolley. It doesn't have a trolley anymore. So that's their job. And there's, they said, you say that the studio is very, very cold. Would a TV studio really be that cold? And I'm remembering a note back from an edit where they couldn't work out why they couldn't hear the audience. And then they had a shot of the audience and they realised they were all wearing gloves. So you couldn't hear them clap. I mean, you've been in the pointless studio many times, unsuccessfully. And so you were, I think before your most recent thing, you were the least successful contestant in pointless celebrities history. Is
I
that
don't,
right?
I don't know if that's true. And it was always my partner's, but one of my partners was my wife, so I'll blame her. I'll blame her for that. I eventually won it, but you know.
I was a real, it was like Rocky. It really was. I mean, the open top bus tour around Kenilworth, I think, was a bit much, but it was lovely to see. I mean, law of averages, you were going to win eventually.
I know. I am the only person who is both a champion of champions of House of Games and Taskmaster, though. So
wow.
Yeah. So how pointless doesn't matter anymore.
And no, if you want a definition of grudging applause, that's what that was. I should say, by the way, as we're talking, Richard, who very kindly agreed to interview me, because I love being interviewed by Richard. If you haven't heard his podcast where he interviews loads of people, it's brilliant. But you're recording this for your book club podcast.
Yes,
well,
so I do a book club version of my podcast, which is me just talking a bit less sillily than usual to authors, usually online. So it's nice to do one face-to-face, but we've had some really good ones and some great ones coming up. Richard Iyawadi's just gone out today. His book is fabulous. Let's not talk about other people.
And it's literally just you talking to people called Richard, is that right?
It is, yeah. I'm trying to get Dickens on it, but he's not returning my calls. you write what you know, but also what I'm quite interested in from a writing perspective as well with this is, you write these books relatively quickly, but there must be quite a lot of research. So there's a big thing about cryptocurrency you seem to have researched fairly thoroughly, unless you knew all about it.
Wow, I'm delighted you think that, because I did pretty much none. I do a book a year, which is what most people do, to be honest. If Lee Child does it, I'm going to do it. That's my that's my basic rule of thumb. But also as a TV producer, and you're used to doing shows weekly or sometimes daily, the idea you would leave 2 years between books doesn't. I just think that's crazy. Yeah. I think if people are enjoying a series, they want the next one as soon as possible. People on Twitter would rather have two a year, and which would be impossible. So I try my best. But I tend not to do much research, I have to say. And I read somewhere that Stephen King said he didn't do any research. So I thought, it's okay then. That was a huge relief. No, I try and sort of write roughly what I think might happen.
Right.
If that makes sense. So with cryptocurrency, I've listened to some podcasts. I know the names of some. In the book, Joyce gets into cryptocurrency. Don't ask how. but she does. I know bits and bobs about it. But if I'm writing, by and large, I'll try and write for 2 hours a day if I can. And if I'm writing, I don't want to spend any of that on the internet looking stuff up. Because if you start looking up cryptocurrency, within 10 minutes you're looking at old clips of Russ Abbott's Madhouse that you've somehow sort of one thing has led to another. So if I'm writing, I tend to just write. So a few things I'll make sure I research. But stuff like cryptocurrency, it's also with cryptocurrency, by the time a book comes out, anything specific you've written will have been superseded anyway.
Yeah.
So you might as well just sort of.
But you need to know the plot involves kind of going back into the past, and just, you need to surely know a little bit about how someone would hack into something like that, or is you.
Well, I have to know how time works for sure.
Okay.
Yeah, I have to. That I will give you. I've looked up. I said, was 2014 before or after 2022? It was. I found out it was before. I thought, hold on, this fits very nicely with the plot that I was thinking of. I'm fascinated in crime anyway, so I read a lot of crime stories. So I know that cryptocurrency essentially is how most real criminals, none of you amateurs, is how they wash a lot of their money these days.
Yeah.
It's such a perfect way to wash money. And, as soon as you know that, actually, you think, that's, I can imagine the infrastructure that goes around that. You know, if there's billions and billions of dollars in that business, you know that there's all sorts of fixers and hangers-on and stuff like that. Sure. And so I just sort of, I imagine what it might be like. You know? But in the same way, I've never murdered anyone.
No, well.
You know? I honestly, listen, I know you never believe me.
I really haven't. It's a good
cover. But yeah, I think sometimes so long as your characters are finding out about things at the same time you are, I don't think some novels you read and they'll have like a, it'd be possible in this book to have written a sort of 10-page essay about cryptocurrency and where it's from and stuff like that, and you just think, come on, get on with the action.
Yeah,
you know, that's what I think.
I mean, I think the books become even more enjoyable as you go on because you obviously get into these characters. I think both as the writer and the reader, and that's why I feel this book, it blossoms even further. The comedy that comes out of it. And I know you're not aiming to really write comedy, but there's some very fun the scene in the studio where Elizabeth and Joyce are interviewing the game show host, asking different kinds of questions is extremely funny.
But yeah, I mean it's interesting that because I love crime fiction. I've always read it, and whenever someone does a funny crime book, I've never really got into it because I think it sort of takes you outside the story a little bit. So I was always very, very careful not to write a funny book. I thought, write a serious book. Whatever you do, don't put any jokes in. And I don't think there are actually any jokes in any of the books, but the characters make me laugh so much with the way they react to things. And if you've got these four characters in their 70s and they all approach problems from different places, it's sort of impossible for them not to make you laugh.
Yeah.
So at no point do I think, oh, here's a setup and here's a joke. Ever. I'm writing a very serious book, and every now and again my characters intervene and say something funny. You think, oh yeah, I'll give you that. But you know, if you send someone into a room, there's no spoilers at all, there's a point in this book where someone comes into a room with very evil intent towards one of our characters, and that's a serious scene, but the way that character deals with it and the way that character gets out of trouble, it's quite funny.
Yeah.
But you know, the scene is not a funny scene, but the character inside the scene I think is funny. I'll read it back sometimes and it makes me laugh, which I know is terrible.
I think it'd be because we love the characters and we get into the characters, and the characters are very real. And you know, I think what's remarkable about it, and what shouldn't be remarkable about it, is that the four protagonists are all in their 70s or above. Yeah. And are all real people with real lives who have, you know.
I know, who'd have thought? Yeah. I mean, that's the question I get asked a lot is, you know, oh, how do you write from the perspective of someone who's in their late 70s? And you think, well, I mean, they're human beings, right? You know, they're just normal people with normal desires and normal, you know, everyone's the same. I mean, what surrounds us as we age differently, of course that changes and the circumstances change, but the brain is the same. I mean, of all people, your brain is still the same as the 21-year-old Richard Herring, right? I mean, you have not matured a great deal, respectfully. But the truth is, none of us have matured.
No.
You know, and the truth is, all of us want the same thing we always want, which is love, which is friendship, which is adventure, which is a reason to get up in the morning. That's what everybody wants. And so my perspective is, you know, I will write about stuff that might happen in your 70s that wouldn't happen in your 40s, but the brain is the same.
Yeah.
You know, the motivation is the same. And so I find it, I mean, they're just characters to me.
Sure.
Rather than old characters.
Of course. And, you know, and it makes sense, of course, you know, if you happen to get these four people together who'd had these pasts, they would make the perfect ancient A-team.
Well, they are the 80s. I mean, I love a gang, and everyone loves gangs. And when you're writing as well, to write a, you know, if you're writing a crime plot and you only have one detective, you're sort of, well, I mean, listen, I haven't done it, and I'm not about to, but to have four detectives means you can, any problem that comes along, I can give it to any one of those four. And I know if something happens, Ibrahim would deal with it in a different way to Ron, and Ron would deal with it in a different way to Elizabeth, certainly. And it's lovely for me to think, whose brain do I want to be in today? Mm-hmm. You know, and to write a character from that perspective. And knowing that the four of them can bicker, but they've always got each other's backs, you know, is such a lovely, you know, it's lovely to write a gang who love each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a moment of tension between two of the characters there, and I don't want to, where a sort of surprising thing happens that is out of character.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting to see how the other characters react to that.
Well, that's the lovely thing. Yeah. And the more you know, that I try to think all the time about funnily enough, I'm just writing the new one at the moment, and so this will highlight what I want to say about it, which is the new one starts on Boxing Day. Yeah. Right, so we begin on Boxing Day, and in Joyce's first diary, we discover what everyone bought each other for Christmas. And it's lovely to know all those different connections, Joyce to Ibrahim, Ibrahim to Ron, Ron to Elizabeth, Elizabeth to Joyce, and write what presents they would get each other and understand the very particular nature of their friendships. It's such a lovely thing to be able to have and to be able to play with. And that chapter, I have to say, is one of the most bits of fun I've ever had writing any Thursday Murder Club stuff, just thinking, I won't tell you what they got each other for Christmas, but I was really making myself laugh, which again is terrible. But in my defense, they were making me laugh by what they bought each other.
I'll tell you one thing only,
which is Ibrahim bought Elizabeth John Ronson's book, The Psychopath Test. But you have to, that's a secret. No one must know that. That's an exclusive from the next book.
But it feels like the character, I mean, especially Joyce, who does write part of the book, it feels like they write themselves at this point as well. You know them so well that it feels like you could, I think with Joyce, it feels like you just...
I wish.
Yeah.
It's true, Joyce is certainly, if ever I'm stuck or if ever I sort of think, oh, I can't write today, I'll sit down and write a Joyce chapter, because she has no filter at all. And to write, that's rather lovely, because she can be talking about Holmes under the hammer, then she's talking about her Hoover, then she's got a theory about the murder, and then she's got to go to the shops, and then she's got a problem with Joanna. And she's very happy to write all that down as a stream of consciousness. It's a great way to hide clues as well, is the truth.
Yeah.
Because I love being in her head so much, and because she's always going from one thing to another, just in the cracks sometimes, you can give a little something away that nobody notices.
Sure. And in talking of that, I mean, these books are now international, really all over the world, but it's of such a British sensibility. And the reference on Moonpig mentioned, I mean, yes. That might be international, I don't know. Claudia Winkleman, And as a reader in Korea or wherever, deal with those references?
It's a very good question. I always find it bizarre that they're successful elsewhere, because, as you say, they're very British. But then, you know, if I read a Japanese book, I want it to be really authentically Japanese.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want them to be, you know, writing something that I might understand, or a Brazilian book. My daughter, who reads Chinese, and she's reading the Chinese version of the book, and she said, I got to tell you, she said, the best bit of the whole book is they have endless footnotes explaining what lilt, Oliver Bonus. So they literally just sort of explain away what all of these different things are. And the Americans always just have a few little notes. Like the one thing that really, really upset them, they were like, we've missed. This was in the first one. And they said, we've missed a part of the plot here, because you say at one point, and we just don't see another reference to it for the rest of the book. You say that Ron goes for a slash in the woods. So I had to explain what having a slash in the woods was to our American cousins. I never saw what they changed it to. They had to change it to something. A waz, what do they say in America?
Oh, yeah. I don't know. Yeah, there's nothing. There's no equivalent. It's the one thing that's untranslatable.
They've forgotten. There's in this new book. In the Bullet the Mist, I love writing Ron. I adore Ron. And again, you're always thinking, well, I need to get across a certain amount of information in a chapter, say. And the key with any chapter is the story has to be fundamentally different at the end of the chapter than it was at the start of the chapter. That's sort of the only rule. And you know where you're headed, which is the end of the book. And just all the way through, just move it on. And you have the fun of thinking, well, where do I set this chapter? I know the information I need to get across. I know if I need to introduce a character or whatever it is, I made Ron go for a couple's massage because I knew he would be so deeply uncomfortable. And I knew as well, one of the key things with writing is when can you get inside a character's head? When are they quiet? And so Ron sort of has this 45-minute massage, and he realizes right at the beginning, like, which to him is torture, but he realizes he's going to have to think about something. He goes, oh no, I've got to take my mind off it. And so actually he's able to go through the story and go through the plot and take you through a little bit and bob. Yeah. And so, you know, that's the lovely thing is when you've got these characters, is whatever information you need to get across is thinking, what's the most fun way? What's the most entertaining way I get this across? Which character is going to give me the most fun today?
Yeah. And I think another very enjoyable thing about the series, and for regular readers, is the continuation, so that there's characters from the previous books that will turn up in this one.
Yeah.
And I've a feeling maybe some characters from this book will turn up in the next one.
I think
one.
So too.
And there's some sort of loose ends, and there's always a few loose ends that kind of to pick up.
Well, I like it's interesting with the Thursday Murder Club, because the one thing I don't want it to be is Murder, She Wrote, God bless Angela Lansbury. I don't want it to be the murder of the week. I don't want them to wake up in the morning and, you know, there's a body on the bowls lawn. And so I have to sort of write the books as if what happened in the first book essentially means that everything that happens in the next four books happens. You know, it just sets into chain, you know, this series of events. Everything that happens in the first book leads to the second book, leads to the third book. And it means that, characters keep coming back in. And also because I love writing, if ever I bring in a new character, you know, my thing is always, if I gave this to an actor, and even if it's two scenes where they say, oh, I'd love to play that character, even if it's minor, so I'm always trying to make the minor characters interesting. But it does mean they're sort of, they are collecting other people like a snowball running downhill.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the first week, there's the four of them, and then Bogdan joins them, and then Donna and Chris, who the cops, join them. And then there's a character called Connie Johnson, who's a local drug dealer. And she's sort of in this book is co-opted into the gang. And you think, okay. But, you know, I think it makes sense. There's another character in this book, an old adversary of Elizabeth's. In fact, that's another thing. So I introduced this guy, and he's called Viktor Ilyich, and he's a former KGB colonel, and Elizabeth knew him from many, many, many years ago. And I won't say what involvement he has in the plot, but there's the scene where we first meet him. So Victor's real special skill is he's not a violent man, but he can persuade anyone of anything, right? He's just a good talker. You know, if you get him into a room, he can persuade you of anything. And in writing, you can never say, you can't just say, and the thing about Victor is he's really persuasive. You know, you have to show it somehow.
Yeah.
And I think, how do you show that somebody can persuade anyone, literally anyone, of anything? What's the ultimate challenge? And so the first time we meet him, he is essentially on hold on the phone trying to get Virgin Media to send someone around to fix his broadband. That afternoon is the thing. And by the end of the scene, you see that he's managed it. Yeah. And then I think from then on, you just think, okay, I listen, you can say whatever you like now. I believe you that this man could get anyone to do anything.
Yes.
Those minor characters. So like Bogdan, for example, who I absolutely love. He has quite a big storyline in this book, The Bullet That Missed. He was literally, he had two lines in one scene in the first book.
Yeah.
Right? I was just writing a scene where I wanted to show that the bad guy, a guy called Ian Ventham, a property developer, I wanted to show that he was a wrong'un. And I was doing that by the fact he was stiffing his builder. He wasn't paying him enough. And the builder was this guy, Bogdan. But then Bogdan said like one line in that scene. Complete, because, you know, you just write it sometimes, it's sort of unexpected. And I thought, oh, wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
You're an interesting character. And then he became sort of like a major part of that book, and now he's like the fifth Beatle. But sometimes it is just, you know, stories sort of start telling themselves sometimes. But whenever an ancillary character comes in, I'm like, I just want them to leap off the page immediately.
Yeah, well, I love that you write that way. And it's, I think, as again, any people who are interested in writing, because obviously some novelists will plan everything out and know exactly where they're going, and it feels like, not that you don't know anything about where you're going, but it feels like you're being surprised by the action as much as anyone else.
Yeah, I think so, and it's not something considered really. I have quite a short attention span, is the truth, and you know, my focus is not everything that it might be. And so what I like to, you know, I do like to surprise myself. I like to know where I'm going, like in a TV format. I like to know, look, at the end, someone's going to get the trophy. Not Richard, but somebody is going to get the trophy. But on the way, yeah, I need to constantly entertain myself. And so I don't have any, you know, I don't have any flow charts on the wall or post-it notes or anything like that. I usually have an idea of what my next five scenes are going to be and, you know, what direction that, you know, we're heading in. And I usually know that there's tent poles I have to hit along the way, but by and large, yeah, I'm just sort of trying to entertain myself on the story, because again, we know the deal. which is there's a murder at the end. I'm going to tell you who did it. So we're all in on that, by and large. So on the way, I just want to go in as scenic a way as possible.
Sure.
You know, and I want to ask as many questions as possible. And I want everyone to be a suspect. And, you know, I want everyone to be a relevant suspect. And so it's, you have to have a little bit of flexibility, I think.
Yeah.
If you know the whole thing all the way through, you're just filling in. I think that would be, it would bore me, I think.
Yeah.
To do that, I'd find that difficult.
And I think because you have so there's it's never just one mystery in any of these books. There's always four or five things that so even if as a reader you almost hit on, I think I know what happened there, you'll sort of be blown out of the water by the other things.
Yeah, so, that's the idea. And I always think if you love the characters, then actually you're sort of not paying quite enough attention. You know, you can make people not pay attention to who did it sometimes because they're enjoying what's going on. And, you know, because some people are brilliant and they work out everything. And so those people, I need them to take their eye off the ball a tiny bit every now and again. And so there's certain scenes you can put in there that you just think, oh, maybe that will distract them for long enough that they won't work out what's happened. But that's the lovely thing about crime fiction is seeding those little clues. You know, because, you know, there is a rule, you know, I have to tell you who did it. Like, it has to be, like, at the end, I can't go, oh, he had a twin. Oh, sorry, he had a twin brother, and that's how he did it. The solution has to be in plain sight all the way through. And so I sort of, the job of hiding that and of suggesting it might be other people, but giving you the concrete evidence it is one person, is the fun of writing and the fun of reading crime fiction, I think. It's that dance that people play, and, you know, there's just using the sort of the memes of previous crime writers to kind of throw people off scent.
Yeah.
It's such a joy to do.
And I'm fascinated by the sky pool that you talk about quite a lot in this book.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's going to come back in any future books, but was that just something that annoyed you? There's a swimming pool that's been made between two buildings that's see-through. Yeah.
Have you seen that on Twitter? In London, they've got these two big residential buildings on the South Bank, and there's a swimming pool in the sky built between these two things. But it's literally right next to the Penguin headquarters.
Right.
You've got the new Penguin headquarters, you've got the American embassy, and then you've got this sky swimming pool. And when I saw it, I just thought, well, that's what a great place for somebody to live.
Yeah.
You know, that's just fun. And yeah, there is, it does sort of crop up as a motif. But it's literally because it's... I looked out, I was visiting my publishers, and I looked up and there it was. And I tend to pick up things from my everyday and put them in the book. If anything in the book is probably something I looked at the day before. Because it gives them a currency.
It does,
Not topical or anything like that, but I love to write about, there's a bit where they're going up to the TV studio, funnily enough, and Joyce comments that the W.H. Smiths at Blackfriars Station must be the smallest W.H. Smiths in the country. And it's only because I'd been there like the previous day, and I thought, this is tiny. And the lovely thing about Joyce is, if I think that, I know that she's going to think it as well, and she would reference it.
I can just imagine that swimming pool full of blood, though, Richard. That's what I was. That was.
Oh yeah,
I'm
yeah,
not
yeah.
saying that doesn't happen, but that would be a lovely thing to see, wouldn't it?
Do you know what? That would be a lovely thing to see. Yeah. Now I think about it, yes. How delightful!
Because it's also that it is that symbol of sort of privilege. It's just as you sort of say. It's just, I think maybe it was in a tweet or maybe it was in the book. It's just sort of showing off arrogance about wealth more than anything, isn't it?
Because Joyce is very, very, very impressed with it.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth says it's just money plus engineering.
Yes, you know. That's it. As well as it being very funny, you are able to, you know, there's some very moving stuff in there that didn't make me cry, but I know a lot of readers have said that that there's bits.
You
of it that
cried I did a little cry. Bit, yeah.
Well, you know, but you talk about the Elizabeth's husband was suffering from dementia or heading that way, and there's some very moving stuff about that, and everyone I think has experienced that in their life to some degree as well.
It's such a common thing now. And you know, and I genuinely think, look, it's lovely. It's all well and good saying, oh, I've got these four heroes, they're in their 70s, aren't they great? Haven't they done terrific? And you know, it's. There's an awful lot of fun there, is the truth. There's an awful lot of fun writing about people who perhaps care less about consequences than they used to. So, you know, I get a lot of benefit of these characters being older. But I think I have to earn that by telling the truth about actually what it is like to be older sometimes. So I think I can have all of that fun, and I can, you know, I can sit here and say, oh, everyone likes mischief and adventure and new friendships. But then, you know, you have to understand that, you know, like when Ibrahim is mugged in the previous book and he feels incapable of going out, Stephen's dementia, you know, grief, you know, there's everyone has had loss. You have to write about that. Otherwise, you can't have the other stuff. You can't have the fun stuff. Because without that, because otherwise it's a fantasy and no one wants to read that. And so I try and make it as true as possible. And if I do that, I have to write about what happens, you know, at that age. And, you know, I talk to my mum and, you know, she lives in a retirement village, and I chat to people. And, you know, the spirit is sensational. It's amazing. But then, you know, my mum will say, look, there's ambulances here every two or three days. So that you can't write about one without writing about the other, I don't think.
No. But that's, you know, again, it's such a linchpin of it is this ever-present fear of death, either by being murdered or just time running out. And that's, you know, that when you came upon this idea and just it sort of fell into your lap in a way, you know, and you suddenly realised, bang, this is it. It is such a strong idea.
Well, that's it. You know, I'd been waiting to write a crime novel for a long time, and I'd sort of just about had the time on my hands finally. And yeah, when I had the idea, again, after a lifetime in TV, you do, you know, where everything is ideas. I mean, every day, that's literally my job, was to go into the office and think of ideas. You know, that's all I did for a whole career. And you do eventually get to understand the sound of an idea that's got something to it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you sit with it and, you know, you wake up the next morning and you still think, no, that's, you know what, that's still got something. And, you know, having made loads of TV shows where you know that the idea is sort of meaningless, because you're going to have to make it. And so the idea has got to be strong. You're going to have to be able to bounce up and down on this idea and really test it and put it in every direction. And it's always still got to work. It's the thing that, you know, TV teaches you. And with the Thursday Murder Club, the moment I had the idea, I sort of felt, I can write about this for a very, very long time. I can see who the characters are going to be. I can see what motivates them. I can see, you know, I can see what's going to happen. And so, as soon as I had it, I think a lifetime of experience said, oh, that's got, you know, sort of the ring of confidence to it.
Talking of your knowledge of game shows, do you think the game show within the book is called Stop the Clock? Do you think it would... Do you think it would fly as a TV format?
I mean, I always, you know, wouldn't it be fun if it did? Yeah. I had fun with Joyce explaining the rules of Stop the Clock to Elizabeth on the way up, because Joyce is a firm fan of it. I sort of remember roughly what the rules were, but I wrote that sentence like in one go.
Right.
You know, I didn't sit down and think, what would this be like? I just sort of thought of all of those meetings where I've had to sort of make stuff up, you know, on the hoof, which occasionally you have to when they hate your first idea. And you have to go, oh no, I've got another one. It's called Stop the Clock now. Everyone's got 60 seconds. You know, well, it has internal logic. Yeah. I mean, if we had to make a pilot of it tomorrow, we could make it. That's for sure.
Okay,
if you're available.
All right, I'll come in. You've talked me into it. I read in an interview that people often shout Helen Mirren at you in the street, which must be confusing for passers-by.
Certainly, if you don't know me, it beats shouting pointless at me in the street. That's the thing. I never, you know, having pointless shouted at you and then people not knowing who you are, and them going, I wonder what that guy's story is. Yeah, everyone likes to cast the film, that's for sure. And that's being cast for real this very second.
Right.
Which is very, very exciting.
Helen Mirren?
I couldn't possibly comment.
Okay. No.
I know one name who's in the frame, but I can't say anything more, but it's really exciting. so that's been cast at the moment, so hopefully they'll film it next year. But no, it's a really fun film to cast in your head.
Yeah.
My mum wants Pauline Collins, that's her mate. Pauline Collins and Penelope Wilton is who my mum wants.
That's good.
But I'll tell you something else about my mum. She is not Steven Spielberg, so it does not matter. It does not matter what my mum
thinks. It
would
explain a lot if she was Steven Spielberg. That would explain your rise to fame.
I don't do many of these events. I'm not doing many this year because I'm trying to write, but I always come back to Cheltenham because I love it, and it's always such fun here. But I also did my local book festival where I grew up, which is I grew up in a town called Haywards Heath, and it was the Cookfield Book Festival, which is where my school was, the next village along. And it was the first time my mum had been to a book event. And She, at the end of it, got more selfies than I did. She's been on the news. She's been on the One Show. It's absolutely unbelievable. In fact, that whole community are absolutely milking it. I've got to say it. They are shocking. But it was so lovely. And that was one that I suspect it won't happen here. Don't forget to send your questions in, by the way. But almost all the questions at the end were, now, my daughter was at school with you, and she says, I thought, wow, that's very different to a normal book event. It was fun, though.
Yeah.
But it was literally my mum and her four mates sitting in the front row. They've been drinking, I did want to say, you see, people don't believe me when I say you're real. Look at you.
It is lovely. So, I mean, you're not going to write the films, you're handing the films over. Are they going to? It's still going to be set in the UK, though, right?
Or it is still going to be set in the UK. Yeah. So it's still going to be very British. All the actors might not necessarily be English actors, but they'll all be doing English accents.
Great.
That's for sure.
So. Dick Van Dyke.
Oh.
Dick Van Dyke as Ron. Dick.
It's perfect. In like 2 years' time, we'll be on the red carpet. And they go, how did Dick Van Dyke become Ron? I go, do you know what? It's Richard Herring. It just snowballed from there. I let them write that because I've got to get on with writing the fourth book.
Yeah.
Is the truth, which I'm so far behind with. You wouldn't believe it. It's so weird because when the book comes out, you're always doing the next one. And so, you know, it's so lovely to have this out and the reaction's been amazing. I'm so thrilled with it. But, you know, then you've got to go home and go, oh, man, I should be on 24,000 words and I'm on 9,000 words. And my agent's not in this yet. No, that's fine. I'm a fair bit behind. But I've got the story.
Yeah.
I've got the story. And there's some fun new characters in the next one as well. And as you say, there's some people that are coming back from this one.
That's good. I like the fact that you're not very judgmental about the evil characters, or the bad characters, I should say.
Yeah.
And you seem to feel there's a chance of almost redemption for everyone.
For some people, well, I think it's up to readers, isn't it?
Yeah.
Who they like and don't like. You know, so Connie Johnson, who she is awful, you know, and she's a drug dealer, and that's pernicious, and we understand that. And you know, she's done bad things, and she hurts people. But she's really fun to write. And in this new book, I did want her to come back because I do find her an interesting character, and certainly a character who's capable of redemption. So in this new book, I sort of, for various reasons, she becomes a client of Ibrahim's, and he gives her therapy. And those scenes are just fabulous to write because, like all therapists, Ibrahim is getting therapy at the same time, is the truth. And so you get Ibrahim and Connie Johnson, two very different people from very different places. They have stuff to deal with the plot, so that's good. They're doing that. But also you're sort of getting to know them both really well and what they think about the fundamental idea of good and evil and all that kind of stuff. If there's no redemption, there's nothing, right?
No, and it's great because she wants revenge because obviously she's in prison, but you still kind of like her. So it's a very well written, you kind of think.
Well, it's fun. I mean, she's saying, just so you know, the second I get out, I am going to kill your friend Ron. And Ibrahim's going, I mean, let's talk about that. Let's talk about why you want to do that. And that's quite a fun scene. That's quite a fun scene to write.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Right, let's go to some questions from the audience before I forget. I did see a good one from James I can't find now, but will you be appearing in the Spielberg film in any way? Will there be a cameo?
I don't think I can do is the truth, because I think if you're watching in the cinema and you'd get people going, why is the guy from Pointless working for Kent Police? This is weird. So I don't think I would love to be. I don't think I can do. I think maybe my mum can be. Although I said to my mum, because all her friends want to be in it, right? They've all said, "Oh, we would like to be in it." My mum's a bit too cool for school sometimes. She said, "Well, I don't know if I'd want to. Would I have to wait around all day?" I'd be like, "What, to be in a Steven Spielberg movie?" Yeah, there might be some waiting around. And then she said, "Well, can they? Is there a way they could do like a CGI, like a hologram of me, so I could be in it, but I wouldn't have to be there?" I was like, "I mean, come on, mum." So I don't think I would be in it,
no.
But hopefully my mum and many of her friends would be in it. That would be fun.
That would be nice. Well, I liked it in Paddington. Michael Bond was in Paddington, just raising a glass.
I mean,
you have to die, really, for that to work.
Well, listen, who knows?
Yeah, OK, cool.
Yeah.
Rebecca asked, and we sort of covered this, but it is something that I'm sure you think about. How many murders in this retirement village before it becomes too unbelievable?
Yeah, that's the truth. I mean, the thing is that actually that the murders aren't really in the retirement village anymore, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
The whole thing started because there was a murder in the retirement village, and that's why the four of them become this gang. And that's what brings them into, the ambit of the police, of Chris and Donna. And in the first book, obviously, Elizabeth is asking a lot of favours from the security services, which leads to a lot of the things that happen in the second book. So, yeah, I think that's the perfect question, because you don't want there just to be murders in that village, because it's statistically impossible.
Yes.
And so right from the beginning of the first one, I knew that we were going to move outside. And in this fourth one, thus far there is not a murder in the village either. Okay. There's a murder very early on, which I just wrote, but not in the village. It's someone we know. It's someone we've met before. That's for sure.
Wow.
But it's not someone in the village.
Yeah. And it does make sense, and you know, and I think the Secret Service past, especially of Elizabeth, absolutely makes sense of it all, and that's sort of that's the linchpin of it, is really, isn't it?
It's that thing of trying to be truthful. So in the first book, you have all the fun of Elizabeth, you know, ringing up people who used to be in MI6 and getting them to come and dig graves in the countryside, and you think, oh, that's fun that her old mates have turned up, and there's an 80-year-old pathologist and all of this. But I was thinking, but if she actually did do that, that would put her on someone's radar, is the truth. You can't sort of do, you know, someone would kind of go, oh, you know that Elizabeth, you know, who's retired 15 years ago, you know that she's using some of our resources.
Yeah.
And the second you do that, of course, the security services will say, well, we've done you a favour. I wonder if you might like to do us a favour, which is essentially the start of the second book. So, you know, that's the idea, is that there's nothing's there just for comic effect. You know, if they do something, you know, it has to have consequences.
And I like the fact that Elizabeth makes a mistake, an understandable mistake in this one. So she's not, she's not like perfect. You know, often when you watch those TV detective things, the detectives all know who's done it before it starts.
Almost the only person who never makes a mistake in these books is Bogdan. He's almost the omnicompetent person.
Yes.
But even he in this book is a little bit more vulnerable, which is great. And I love particularly Joyce's delight when Elizabeth does something wrong. In fact, all three of them, their delight when she gets something wrong is lovely to write.
Vic and Rod say, we named our caravan Joyce in honour of your famed character.
Wow. That's cool.
See, that's a good way to get your question read out.
Isn't it just?
The question's no good. it is good, actually. Which character do you think is most like you? We think Elizabeth.
Wow. I mean, no offence taken. Because I thought Bogdan, really. It's a really good question, and it's, you know, when people say, are they based on anyone? And I do think the four of them are sort of the four quadrants of my brain, is the truth. And when people talk about characters in writing. People say, how do I make my characters different to each other? And I always think all four of those characters are me. But if I'm writing an Ibrahim chapter, I just go into the bit of me that, you know, sort of worries a bit too much and likes to put things in lists. You know, I just go into that bit of my brain. And if I'm Joyce, I just go into the kind of, I'm just relaxing in front of the snooker and I'm just going to write something. So I think all four of them are very like me. If I was most like one of them, I it's probably a mix between Joyce and Ibrahim would be where I am. I would love to be like Elizabeth, I don't have her certainty of character.
Which, I mean, who do you think is the best character, and is it Joyce? Because it is.
Well, listen, my favourites change day by day, is the truth. Usually my favourite character, people sometimes say, is it fun, you know, are these things fun to write? Which is a really good question. And every writer will tell you, it's not really fun to write anything, is the truth, because writing a book is really hard. But then I have really, really thought about it. And actually, almost all the bits that end up on the page are the bits that were fun to write. That's the truth. The days where you're thinking, I'm loving spending time in the companies of these characters.
Yeah.
That's the stuff that ends up on the page. And that's usually when you're thinking, I absolutely love this character, you know? And so I have differences all the time. Joyce is my most fun to write.
Okay. Patrick asks, I think there might have seen two people asking this question. What did Joyce say to Ibrahim to persuade him to leave the house and the man who died twice?
Well, that's the point, isn't it? That's Joyce's secret. She's writing a diary for you. She's got to have some little secrets. And I think the reason I don't say what she says is that scene is about what friendship is, and it's about true friends, and it's about when somebody is telling you that their life has gone wrong and they can't do anything about it, and it's probably best just to leave them alone, and you know, they'll be fine. That a really true friend, a good friend, knows the thing to say. And that's what that scene is. It's essentially just saying, it's showing you that those two, that Joyce really understands Ibrahim and that Ibrahim really trusts Joyce. That's what that scene is saying.
Yeah, but what does he say then?
She says they're doing three frazzles for a pound in the...
there's a little bit of controversy over this, I think, incorrectly. I love Leslie Manville's narration on the first two audiobooks.
Yeah.
Where did she go?
She went to the Crown.
Right.
She was literally all set up and ready to go, and the Crown moved their filming forward. I think she's Princess Margaret in the Crown. She's amazing, Leslie. But Fiona Shaw is Fiona's best mate, and also is incredible, you know, and has been in, you know, Harry Potter and Bond and, you know, Killing Eve and everything. And so Fiona Shaw literally the next day said, I'll take over the mantle. And I think she's amazing. They're both amazing. But, you know, those things, you can't do anything about it. You know, if the Crown comes calling,
yes,
you know, you sort of have to. And she was gutted and we were gutted. But, you know, Fiona is absolutely amazing. People don't like, you know, people don't like change. I get it.
They don't, but also not everything works as an audiobook, and I think these books really work as audiobooks. And you know, all three of them I've listened to rather than read myself, and it's a really great way. They're both fantastic, I think.
I think she's amazing. But I do, you know, I get it. I don't like when things change. But it's, you know, certainly I tell you who would complain, Ibrahim. he wouldn't like that. Joyce would be absolutely fine. Joyce would say, for the first 2 minutes I didn't like it at all, and then I thought, do you know what? She's actually terrific. Elizabeth would say, get over yourself. She's wonderful. But Ibrahim would say, I think if you have the same narrator for the first two, I think it's very, very important to have that consistency. And were it me, I would have simply put back the audiobook release for a month or so that Leslie Manville could have kept doing it. So I think that's what he would have said.
Okay.
I was like just delighted that Fiona Shaw said yes, because she's such a hero of mine.
Right. This person has remained anonymous, and I'm not surprised because they're ashamed of themselves. Is it wrong that Alan the dog is one of my favourite characters?
Oh. You could not be more correct. And again, it's so lovely having Alan. Firstly, you know, it's wonderful to have a dog, and it really does make them the famous five. But I love having you can have a really serious scene where everyone is upset with each other, or, you know, something very serious is going on, and it just means that every sort of 10 lines or so, someone can just say, "Not now, Alan." and it's just it gives it a truth, you know. I love to have Alan. He's ironically a very humanizing character. Alan,
good. Okay, this is from Lindsay. This is quite an interesting point. Ian Rankin said earlier today that police detective novels are dying and being replaced by yours. I was talking to Ian in the green room, and he is a fan of yours, so I don't think it's quite as blunt as that. How does that make you feel? And I guess that, you know, I know this has been this is an accusation that's always levelled at a sort of a celebrity coming in and joining any genre of writing.
Nothing dies is the truth, no. You know, and you know, 5 years ago, the only thing you were allowed to write was sort of psychological thrillers with an unreliable narrator. And that's when I started writing Thursday Murder Club, which is completely different to anything that was being written at the time is the truth. You know, lots of police procedurals, lots of, you know, very dark, you know, who do you believe type books. And I wanted to write something different. And, you know, it's been different. And I guess in the wake of it, that there will be other books like it, but that's not my responsibility. I'll keep writing the ones that I love. Now, the lovely thing about the crime community really is because I've been involved in it for years, and I've always been at the crime conventions and, you know, seeing Ian and Mark Billingham and Val McDermott, all these brilliant people. They so immediately understood that I wasn't like a Johnny Come Lately who was trying to, you know, the truth is, if you were trying to make a quick buck, you would not write a crime novel. It's really hard. Yeah. You know, it's not, you have to really, really, really want to, is the truth. And so I've been so fortunate that they've all been fabulous. And, you know, and Ian's been slightly, he's not being disingenuous, that sounds rude, but he knows that he's selling more books than ever, you know, because people are loving crime fiction now. Yeah. And Ian, I think, is a absolute genius, and I've read Rebus forever. And the fact that, you know, he's just got these huge number one hits every year, and, you know, it's lovely to see. But more and more and more people are reading crime fiction. And, you know, I think he recognises that a rising tide raises all ships. But, people will tire of sort of amateur detectives in a few years and want the police procedurals back. I mean, you know, everything goes in and out of fashion. But at the moment, yeah, these amateur detectives are having a moment. But none of it, apart from my books, is my responsibility.
No.
You know, I'll do my bit. Other people can write books if they want to. But I'll just keep doing the thing that I would love to read.
And the worldwide sort of sales suggest that Pointless isn't necessarily...
Yeah,
all exactly. The reason people are buying it.
I was going to say, yeah, when it was interesting, when we were first going out to set up, I did worry a tiny bit. I mean, I knew that I knew I love crime fiction. I knew I'd always been a writer. But when the Germans bought it before the Brits bought it, I thought, oh, okay, that's all right, because they have literally no idea who I am. They just read the book, loved the book, loved the story, loved the characters. And then when Spielberg came in and bought the rights, you just think, oh, maybe it's okay. That's the thing that sort of gave me some confidence. But yeah, the next thing I'm going to write is a police procedural, Ian. Sorry. set in Brighton, Nick. Well, I am going to write a slightly more traditional detective story next.
Right.
But it won't be a police procedural. But I love a police procedural.
Yeah. So you're going to have a fourth Thursday Murder Club, and then a new.
Yeah.
This is the new thing.
Fourth Thursday Murder Club. There will be other Thursday Murder Clubs in future. I'm not stopping them. I just want to do the first four as a sort of a quartet. And then try something else. So I'm doing something about a detective agency, really. I mean, as I said, and about the question about how many murders can you have in the village, you know, having these unconventional detectives is hard. So I wanted to write a conventional detective story, because in that story, you can have your main character, your detective, sitting behind a desk, and someone can literally knock on the door and say, here's your plot. Here's the plot for this book, which is a really, really lovely thing to have, because you can go anywhere there and you can explore anything. And so it's essentially about a detective duo, a private investigator duo, who are a father-in-law and a daughter-in-law. And the father-in-law is an ex-cop and the daughter-in-law is a close protection officer for sort of billionaires. That's her world. And she brings him into her world. So they essentially sort of go around the world solving murders that no one else can. He very reluctantly... Because he just wants to sit at home and, you know, do the pub quiz on a Tuesday afternoon. But it's about a sort of reluctant detective duo.
Right. That's great. Well, I love the fact that in this book that there's one joke, and I don't want to ruin it, but there's a joke that for fans of the series and who know the history of the series will really enjoy it. It's towards the end. It made me laugh out loud as I listen to it, so I look out for that, but I don't want to spoil it. Do you think that? I love there's a community, and you know, and people obviously people.
Was that the Waitrose joke?
It is the Waitrose.
Oh, we can give that away. That's all right. I try. You know, occasionally you get stuff wrong in a book. Of course you do. And it's always my fault. But in the foot. So as I say, you get people who check everything, right? Everything, the tiniest little details. And it says something about this mistake that nobody bothered to check it. In the first book, in fact, the scene where we first meet Bogdan, someone pulls up to the Waitrose in Tunbridge Wells, right? Someone drives up to the Waitrose in Tunbridge Wells, and we have the scene. It turns out, and this will shock you, there is no Waitrose in Tunbridge Wells. And which is so absurd that nobody checked. Like, absolutely nobody checked. And I felt guilty ever since. And people from Tunbridge Wells always have a go at me saying, oh, I think they felt it quite badly anyway. And now this made it worse. And so there's a scene in this book where Joyce goes to Tunbridge Wells and she said, I was disappointed because I'm sure I'd read somewhere there's a Waitrose, but there isn't.
It's so nice. But I think that...
That's my apology to people
as well. It's very nice. But I think that, you know, it is... I think you've got this community and everyone loves these characters. And do you think there's... I mean, you know, is there any chance that any of them aren't going to make it through to the end of however many books there will be?
I'm so sorry, everybody. That was, it had all been going so well, hadn't it? You should always keep everything on the table for the sake of jeopardy. But I will unequivocally say I'm not going to kill any of the four of them. That to me is like a car doesn't drive on three wheels, right? I need all four of them to be extant and for as long as they possibly want to. So I'm not. I wouldn't get rid of any of them. Is the truth. Maybe in like 10 years' time, when you know a tax bill comes in, maybe I'll think, okay. Actually, do you know what, Ron? I think your time is up. I don't particularly want. I wouldn't want to do that. Is the truth. Yeah. You know, other characters, you know, might do, but the four main characters, I think, are staying exactly where they are.
Yeah. Though, imagine them all in the sky pool. A big whisk goes in, takes them all out at once.
Ah, that's clever. I have to say, I don't want them to age too quickly.
No.
Because you know that would be an issue. But I tend to start the next book almost immediately after the previous book. So they've only aged by about 6 months in the first three books. So, yeah. You know, I'm hedging my bets.
Just a murder a day. Yeah, exactly. That they solve in the day. Yeah, it'll be like 24.
For the next 365 years.
Yeah. Well, it's lovely to talk to you about it. It's absolutely fantastic, but there's lots more we could talk about. I'm sure everyone's going to buy it anyway, but go ahead and buy it. And Richard will be signing in to the Waterstones afterwards. I'm doing a book event where I'm being interviewed later about my book, Can I Have My Ball Back? It's a very funny story about having testicular cancer.
There we go.
It's nice and funny.
And does the main character die?
Eventually, apparently.
Yeah, okay.
I think he might become immortal as a result of survive. That's my understanding. That's at the town hall at 8:30, I think, but I'd love to see you there. But ladies and gentlemen, please give a massive round of applause to the incredible Richard Osman.
Thank you, everybody. And a huge round of applause for Richard Herring as well, please.
Thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
Thanks, Richard.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks for listening. Go to gofasterstripe.com for all your Rich Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can. And make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.